Hello, everybody, and I am back with Mark Kosak-Holland. We're talking about the Titanic, and I just wanted to take a quick moment before we get back with Mark to mention that there is a Titanic display at the library at the moment. Obviously, some books, a mix of fiction and nonfiction. Of course, a lot of people have taken that story and turned it into a novel of some sort. There are some new ones, Voyagers of the Titanic, and then there is one by Hugh Brewster, RMS Titanic. There's also another new book on order, and Mark, you are familiar with this person, Violet Jessop. They had discovered her memoirs. She was a survivor of two disasters, two sinkings. One was the Titanic, and the other was...
Britannic.
Thank you. It was the third one in the series,
right,
wasn't it?
Yep.
I was surprised that they went ahead and built the third one.
Well, they were already in the process of designing and early stages of the Britannic when the Titanic was sunk.
That's right. And I believe that the plan was to name it Gigantic.
That's right.
But they decided after the Titanic, they didn't want to have any association. Right. Yes, that was good. However, back to the Titanic, if you don't mind, I don't want to give away all the good things, but there were some wonderful stories that you were telling me. I had that information you emailed me, and I appreciate that, about the binoculars. I just couldn't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, sure. So, we were talking about the compromises that were made during the project, but there was also a number of compromises that were that happened in the maiden voyage, and part of it was because the maiden voyage was so rushed.
Yes.
The maiden voyage basically, as soon as the ship was built, it was literally went into its maiden voyage, so there was no testing. The whole voyage itself was absolutely chaotic because they were still trying to do tests that they'd missed in the sea trials. They didn't go through formal sea trials.
It's kind of like buying into the beta version.
Yes, it was. It was very much so. So basically, the officers and crew were under a lot of pressure because of everything that was going on. And also, they were trying to match the expectations of the Olympic in terms of providing the most luxurious crossing. The maiden voyage was actually very important because if you got that right, then it would guarantee passage further on. So what happened was the binoculars were missing on the first day. And the two lookouts reported it to the officers. And the officers did nothing about it. We know now that the binoculars were basically locked away in a locker where one of the officers was transferred just before the Titanic left and he went to a different ship. But the point was these were tools of the trade for the lookouts.
Yes.
And without them, they couldn't really do a full job.
Well, that's right. That's where you have to, as an employee, you rely on your manager, your top people to see that this is a potential problem. Let's fix it.
That's right.
And they seem to dismiss it.
Right. Now, the officers had binoculars, but they didn't bother sharing them with them because this was a class issue, because they saw the lookouts as lowly lookouts that hadn't gone through naval college. They were just there to spot anomalies. And then the officers, once they were told about the anomaly, would do the analysis and make the decision on it. So they weren't thought worthy of sharing binoculars with.
Amazing. That's so important to have. I can see how this is a good project management. I mean, I've worked on different things over my life, too. And you think, well, this person's got their attitude and you learn to live with that and you deal with it. But we're talking lives. And it obviously came to that. So the importance of the binoculars, if they had had them, they would have seen the ice flows.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it dark?
It was, but they were struggling with what they saw on the horizon. It took them about 7 minutes before they actually rung the warning down to the bridge.
7 minutes?
7 minutes, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to ask probably a stupid question. It's a big ship. I've hit an iceberg. It's taken me 7 minutes to figure that out.
Well, it was all to do with the sea conditions at night. I mean, first of all, it was a very calm sea, but there was a lot of haze around because it was so cold. It was like 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And what they saw was a black object in the distance. Now, they thought it was a breakaway through the ice field itself. But in fact, it probably was a blackberg, an iceberg that had picked up coal or dirt and flipped over. So that's probably what they were looking at.
Interesting. Okay. And it's also a huge ship.
Right.
If they're not out on deck looking at these things, what are they doing inside? Because you talked also about the internal, not sound system.
Communication.
Thank you.
Right. Now, that was even a bigger compromise than the binoculars. What happened there was these ships were very reliant on receiving warning messages, ice warning messages, and the problem they had was, and they didn't discover this until sort of recently, really, we've uncovered the truth here, is that the Marconi system, which basically relied on ship-to-ship and ship-to-shore mm-hmm. communication, was actually run by Marconi operators that were employed by Marconi because he was trying to protect his technology. He didn't want it to be ripped off.
I see.
So the problem was the two Marconi operators weren't actually underneath the ship's structure. They weren't actually part of the crew. And they were paid on the number of telegrams they processed. Now, they were inundated with commercial traffic because all these millionaires on board sending out all these telegrams to friends in New York and so on. So in the 2-3 days before the actual disaster, they had been run off their feet.
Okay.
And the ice warnings that were coming in were being parked on the side and weren't going up to the bridge in a sequential fashion or even going up there at all. In fact, what should have happened, the officers should have picked up on this and gone down to collect these ice warnings to build up this map. So the map they actually had of the Atlantic and where ice was positioned was inaccurate.
It just makes me, you know, cringe, because I would think that the people who are manning those Marconi stations mm-hmm. would also realize that their lives depend on getting that information to the upper levels. But they're taking their orders from "I'm being paid to..."
Yeah. They were driven by metrics. They were driven by their own set of metrics, different mm-hmm. sets of metrics. Mm-hmm. Again, this is a really good offshoot of the story.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. Okay, so is there anything else you'd like to tell us about this particular Titanic event before...
Well, I'll just talk about the grounding because
that's probably interesting.
So what the evidence mm-hmm. is showing, and there's quite a lot of evidence, and this isn't from the wreck. This is basically from people looking at the inquiries. That mm-hmm. there was very much a whitewash that went on within the inquiries. Mm-hmm. And there's very strong evidence to indicate that the Titanic actually struck ice, meaning it grounded itself onto an ice shelf protruding from possibly an iceberg rather than sort of a sideswipe. Because if there'd been a sideswipe, there'd been tremendous collateral damage, which there wasn't. There was no broken bones, there's no fatalities or anything like mm-hmm. that. Now, we do have, again, from the transcripts, engineers claiming, quite a few passengers also claimed that the ship was restarted. Mm-hmm. And it basically was heading northwest towards Halifax.
Okay.
So the grounding theory basically proposes that the ship was actually taken off the ice shelf because mm-hmm. initially the damage that was reported by the first assessment party was negligible. There was no major damage.
Right.
But because they pushed the ship over the ice shelf, the plates further impounded themselves upwards and the flooding increased.
Yes.
So the decision to move off the ice shelf was actually the catastrophic decision mm-hmm. that sunk the Titanic.
Yeah. Now, let's back up for our listeners and tell us, how did you find this research? Where did you go for this information?
Well, just different sources. There was one notable book, which is called The Last Log of the Titanic by David Brown, and he basically built a sequence map. But this grounding theory has been very well accepted by the Titanic Society and all the Titanic mm-hmm. buffs that are out there. They think it's a very plausible, because Walter Lord, when he wrote his book, he talked about flooding coming from underneath.
All right.
There's a lot of problems with the sideswipe. And really, it's one of those things that I was hoping would be solved by this point, you know, by the centenary, a little bit like the JFK assassination.
Well, actually, what can they tell by going down there? They have had different...
They found nothing.
They found nothing that
will help us with that. There is far more evidence within the inquiries themselves. So these were two inquiries that were run right after in the US and the UK.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I think you have a better grasp of the time frame. They sat on that shelf for moments.
Yeah, for a few minutes.
And then they went forward for quite a long time.
Yeah, they continued to sail forward for about 20 minutes.
Yes.
At a speed of about 7 or 8 knots.
Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that while you're pulling forward, doing damage, why isn't there a connection going on with a captain at this point? Like, hey, that's a mistake to go forward.
Because he was under so much pressure from Bruce Ismay. Bruce Ismay... Mm-hmm. really influenced him in restarting the ship and sailing
her off. He was right there with the captain.
He was there. And in many ways, it was the arrogance about the ship itself that the ship was practically unsinkable. Now, for Ismay, if he sent out warnings at the time, that would have blown all the investment he made in marketing the ship. But what greater publicity stunt than a ship saving itself,
getting itself
to Halifax?
That's right. Now, do you think that, and we probably won't know this, but do you think they thought they sideswiped the iceberg?
No. The sideswipe came out later on in the inquiries. One of the experts came up with that concept. Now, the remaining officers allowed that information to pass because they were basically being coached by Ismay not to say anything that could damage
their image.
Their image and what had gone on. So that's where the whitewash came out of it. Basically, Ismay was trying to do everything he could to get back to the UK.
Right.
He was sending telegrams to White Star to make sure that there's a ship there waiting for me in New York so I don't have to step onto US soil. But as soon as he stepped onto US soil, he was subpoenaed, right? House arrest, and he was kept in the hotel where the inquiry was going on.
Is that
on.
What happened?
That's exactly what happened.
Oh, wow.
Right, because he didn't want to face a US inquiry. He knew the UK inquiry would be far more lenient, and it was.
Mm-hmm.
The UK inquiry basically nailed the British Board of Trade and Captain Lord for not coming to the rescue. And that's because the UK government needed large ships because they knew the war was coming. Right?
And
this
is
1912. Exactly. They need large ships to transport troops from Canada, materials and so on. So that's why they kept White Star afloat.
Isn't that amazing? And that's actually what happened to the third in this series, isn't it? The Britannic.
That's right.
Taken right into service for the war.
That's right. And the same with Olympic. Olympic was used as a troop carrier.
Oh, that's right, because it's still around.
Yep.
So that killed that service, that
fancy
crossings and whatnot. So that brings me back to the Violet Jessop book, where she survived both those catastrophes. So you might want to read her book as well as Mark's book on this project management. Now, it was, remind me again of the title.
Project Management Blunders.
Blunders, that's right. And that is a big one. That is a big one. I'm also looking forward to your other book, The History of Project Management. Can you tell us, will that be similar, looking back at history where some big projects went wrong or did it well?
That is a different book completely. That basically looks at 20 landmark projects from the beginning of civilization, but it looks at these projects through a project management lens. So there's been a lot of written about many of these projects like Giza or Colosseum or the Parthenon, but they've all been written by architects or engineers, whereas this looks at it very much from a project perspective.
Mm-hmm. I think they're both going to be very fascinating, and I think a lot of our listeners out there are going to enjoy your books. So I appreciate you coming in, Mark, taking some time out of your work. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Shelf Life, news from the Whitchurch Stouffville Public Library. For more information about library programs and services, check out our website at www.whitchurch-library.on.ca. Or you can call the library at 905-642-7323 or toll free at 1-888-603-4292. Or why not visit the library in person at 30 Burkholder Street in Stouffville? Thank you for listening.